the Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Luke. Jesus came down with the 12 apostles and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. They had come to hear and to be healed of their diseases, and those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all in the crowd were trying to touch him, for power came from him, and all were healed. Then he looked up at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for surely your reward is great in heaven. That is what their ancestors did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will become hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets." The Gospel of our Lord.
Woe to you. Yeah, I'm loving this. But the way of the wicked is doomed. If we were an evangelical church, we'd be having a field day with these. But I'm going to help you out here today. The Jesus that is portrayed in the Gospel of Luke is one that kind of gets right in people's faces about questions of wealth. And unlike the similar passage in the Gospel of Matthew, where we hear the Beatitudes, this whole section known as the Beatitudes, in Matthew it says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Oh, we're all off the hook now. Well, not so in the Gospel of Luke. I mean, right in your face, right in my face, "Blessed are the poor, and woe to the rich." So, I'm going to share a little secret with you today. Who's got a Bible in your pew rack? Anybody? You got one laying around? Bust that puppy out. Now, I know it's a little much. This is the Episcopal Church. You know, we're not real good at Bible thumping. In fact, we're terrible at it. Yay! But we do actually keep Bibles in the pews. You guys don't have one? Because I wanna. Yeah, that's a prayer book. I had some, but I gave them away earlier. Okay. Well, you're just Andrew. You're just gonna have to take our word for it. So find the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, the opening lines of the Gospel of Luke, because this is the best kept secret about this gospel, and it's what makes the difference between this story and the others. Anybody find it? Would someone be willing to read the opening line? Debbie? Oh, and Debbie's here. She is here. So, Tracy, you can relax. Go ahead. I'll tell you when to stop. Do it a little louder, please. Oh, you know what? Susie, grab that microphone, and then you don't have to strain your voice there. Yeah. Fire that thing up. There you go, Debbie.
Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus.
Stop right there. Thank you. This gospel, the Gospel of Luke, and its sequel, the Acts of the Apostles, are addressed to some dude named Theophilus. And herein lies the major clue that gives us the context for what's going on in the sixth chapter when Jesus is cutting loose with these sort of raw beatitudes and woes. Theophilus is a Greek name. This guy, whoever he is, or who knows, it could be a group of people. Either way, it doesn't really matter. This is not a Jewish person. This is a Greek name. This person is not steeped in the Jewish tradition. And you can tell from the nature of the language, because this is highly polished Greek. Think of the best novel or story you've ever read, and that part of what makes it such a wonderful story is the polished nature of the language. If you got that, and then contrast that, say, with the Gospel of Mark, that's just they did this, and it's there's no polish whatsoever to this or any of the other stories. Not like this. This is fancy schmancy language addressed to a fancy schmancy person. Theophilus, it turns out, is probably a patron of some ancient community of followers of Jesus, which makes this guy wealthy. And so, unlike the other Gospels addressed to Jewish communities, whose lives are being dismantled and taken apart by Imperial Rome, and their livelihoods destroyed, their cities and towns burned to the ground, their crops co-opted by Roman military, this guy's got some means. And is part of what we now refer to as the patronage class, the wealthy class of the Roman Empire, and is benefiting from all the wonderful things about imperial power. The story is addressed to a completely different audience. And so it's no wonder that Jesus is portrayed in the Gospel of Luke as a wisdom teacher and a healer who's going to get right in people's faces about the question of wealth. You know, how you acquire it, how you live with it, how you share it, or, more to the point, how you are constricted by it and distracted by it. And there's the big secret about the Gospel of Luke. So as we continue on this year, and we continue to read stuff, and it's kind of getting in our face, under our craw and whatnot, Jesus is getting in our grill, that's why. And it doesn't then take a big genius to extrapolate and go, oh, well then he could as easily be talking to us, because I'm looking around the room, and no one here is poor. Sorry. You may think you're poor, but you're not, and nor am I. I mean, we have property, we have means, we have vehicles, we have jobs. I mean, we are blessed with so much, regardless of our attitude. And so, a lot of this gospel could be directed to us. So, let's just get real clear, real quick, about the nature of this thing. This, unbeknownst to many folk in the evangelical community, the Gospel of Luke is not the prosperity gospel. In the early founding of our nation, there were Christian and religious leaders that decided that the best way to sort of key into this new nation and, you know, all the cool things that were going on in this country after the Revolutionary War was to create this thing called the prosperity gospel. God helps those who help themselves, right? We love that phrase, don't we? And it took root in this country, and it has been maintained throughout our history in the United States. And I am here to tell you it is a lie. Nowhere in the scriptures does it say God helps those who help themselves. And especially in the Gospel of Luke and its sequel, the Acts of the Apostles, this is not the God of prosperity. This is not the God who helps those who help themselves. Again, for clarity's sake, this is the God who has a specific partisan preference for the poor, the oppressed, the downtrodden, the marginalized. And it gets worse. Because all of these writers, including this fancy schmancy writer, writing to this fancy schmancy guy, Theophilus, has enough wherewithal to know that this God is also the ancient God of the Hebrews and of the Hebrew scriptures. And oh, by the way, that God, described in a variety of ways, is also thought of as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And does anyone here remember any of those stories well enough to know who these guys were? Who were they? Well, yeah, they were Jews, or at least we think they were. But even more important, I'll give you that. You know this is a trick question. Donna was exhibiting great courage there a second ago by responding. The rest of you knew not to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So here it is, folks. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their families and their progeny, for all, these guys are refugees. Yeah, we conveniently forgot that part of the story. And so, in effect, this is not just the God who has a specific partisan preference for the poor and the marginalized and the dispossessed. This God is the God of refugees. And so that we're willing to collect a bunch of shoestrings to help out folks who have been imprisoned because they're refugees, guess what we just did? We just aligned ourselves with the God of the Bible. So good on you, Veronica, and thank you for leading the charge on that one, and we will continue on with that kind of work. Do you see where this is going, folks? This is not the prosperity gospel. Time to drop that hot rock. So, we say to ourselves, well, if we're not the poor, and we're not the dispossessed, and we're not the downtrodden, and we're not the marginalized, and we're not even refugees, where does this gospel leave us? I'm so glad you asked. Woe to the rich, says Jesus in Mark's gospel. Where does that leave us? Well, let me give you a couple of clues. Go back to the language of Psalm 1. In fact, go ahead and crack that page again. Allison, do you remember what page that's on? 585. Take a look at Take a look at Psalm 1, because now we're going to get to the heart of the matter, folks. And again, it's a little subtle, but this is important stuff for us understanding our place in God's realm and in God's creation. Psalm 1, which sets the tone for the entire Psalter, and is probably right up there with my favorite psalm, right next to Psalm 62, that opens with, "For God alone my soul in silence waits," describes the difference between the righteous and the wicked, for the wicked will be doomed. And again, from the vantage point of that prosperity gospel and some of the weird stuff that you and I have been taught about this, and we've talked about Psalm 1 before, so hopefully this won't come as any great shock to you. The categories of righteous and wicked have nothing to do with your little moral world. But rather, wickedness, and look at the first line, look at verse 1. It says, wicked, and then it says, sinners, and then what's the third descriptor at the very end? The scornful, or a better translation of that word, scoffers. I love that word, scoffers. The wicked are understood in the Scriptures, not just in Psalm 1, but all throughout and right on into the Christian Scriptures as those who are not teachable. And, even better, those who claim self-sufficiency. I can hardly say it. Self-sufficiency. Or, from the vantage point of our culture, and again, this is a distinctly American phenomenon, those who have claimed autonomy, which, if we're willing to tell the truth about ourselves, is the greatest virtue and value of America. Autonomy! Nobody's the boss of us. No one's going to tell us what to do. Yeah. I'm my own. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. This is a whole set of myths and fantasies that were generated by our forefathers and our foremothers to claim their place on the planet during what became known as the United States of America. And we need to recognize that they are fantasies. And the notion of autonomy, the notion of self-sufficiency, is understood in the Scriptures as wicked. There is no other definition of the word in the Scriptures than that.
Yikes.
Going to have to think through, you know, a little bit of our history, a little bit of our story, right? You know, and the whole God helps those who help themselves. Got to go, folks. We got to jettison that stuff. In order to put ourselves in the position of what the psalmist and the rest of the Scriptures describe as the righteous. Now, again, just to be clear, when you and I hear language like this, we instantly kick into our individual shtick, right? And begin to think of self-righteousness, which, according to the Scriptures, is wicked because it's self-referenced. Anything that is self-referenced, self-centered, which, you know, that's the easy one, but self-sufficiency, autonomy, all that good stuff, that all of that draws us in the direction of what the Bible calls the wicked. And so we've got to begin to imagine ourselves in a whole different way. And not self-righteous, but righteous in terms of what the Buddhists call right relationship. A couple of examples. How many of you folks are familiar with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? Anybody? Oh, yeah, a whole bunch. Awesome. Anyone who's familiar with the 12 steps, and this is a fabulous modern example of what the psalmist and, frankly, what Jesus is talking about here, what the 12 steps do when we engage them is start with the idea of being powerless, which, again, is very un-American. But we recognize that we've employed all our power, all our good ideas, all our hard-won worldly wisdom, and they've gotten us nowhere. In fact, for an alcoholic or an addict or somebody in the grips of a compulsion or obsession, what that kind of self-propelled stuff has done is dug us right into a hole. And so the steps begin with powerless over whatever that thing might be. Life is unmanageable. And then the second step, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves and that power can restore us to sanity. And then the third step, and here it comes, folks, make a decision on a daily basis to turn my will and my life over to the care of that higher power. And all of a sudden, if we're taking these steps seriously as a path to recovery and as a spiritual path, we are moving from self-sufficiency and a self-referenced life to God-centered. And, even better, community-centered. Because every alcoholic in recovery that I know, addict, overeater, anyone with a compulsion or obsession, will tell you that what saves their bacon more than anything is finding their place in the community. And so we are referenced to something other than just our self. And there's deep and abiding power in that. And at least from the vantage point of the spiritual path of the 12 steps, that power is God. So it's a fabulous modern example of recognizing the difference between righteous and wicked, and it's going to take us in the direction of dealing with the teachings of Jesus in Luke's gospel about blessed are the poor and woe to the rich. So let's start heading in that direction. So the other day, once again, in this wonderful common prayer book that I use in my morning meditation, a British author, a guy named John Stott, is quoted, and he writes this: simplicity is the first cousin of contentment. It recognizes that we are pilgrims. It concentrates us on what we need and measures this by what we use. It rejoices in the good things of creation, but hates waste and greed and clutter. It knows how easily the seed of the word is smothered by the cares and riches of this life. So to the extent that we're willing to imagine something other than a life of self-sufficiency, we have a chance. And we open ourselves up to what the ancient ones, from the vantage point of the scriptures, described as instruction or Torah. Now, just a quick note on Torah. Again, we've rendered that, unfortunately, as law, as though it's a bunch of rules. But what the ancient ones knew, and Jewish people to this day understand, is that instruction is an ongoing endeavor. And yes, some of it comes from the written scriptures, a whole bunch of it comes from the community, and if you actually were to read the Bible, you would discover that God's original instruction is creation. Whoa. And so to the extent that you and I are willing to pay attention to what's going on around us, both in the community and in creation around us, we become something other than self-referenced and self sufficient. Debbie, you had your hand up? Sure. Divine creation. Anybody want to define creation for Debbie? Here's my 10 cents on that. It's all things seen and unseen. And so, you know, the earth, the planets, the stars, I mean, go back to Eucharistic Prayer C in the prayer book, planets, stars, the galaxies and their courses, and this fragile earth, our island home, that would all be constituted as creation. All living things, all sentient things, all non-sentient things as well. Creation. And that creation is God's original instruction. Ponder that for a moment, and I'll just leave that with you. And so the ancient ones, again, are saying, and what Jesus is saying is, if we're willing to become teachable and open to other possibilities, then we're gonna have a chance. Finally, this wonderful little book that was given to members of the ministry team by Pam Ertl, our Christian educator. It's called A Little Rule for Beginners, Insights into Benedictine Spirituality. It's written by a wonderful Benedictine nun named Joan Chittister. She's a favorite among some of us. And it's written for kids, but it's real good for adults as well. And I saw this in chapter 33, entitled Monastics and Private Ownership. It says, all things should be the common possession of all, so that no one possesses ownership of anything. Now, before I go on, I have to tell you that I vaguely remember the 60s. Vaguely. And there were groups of people, I never had the wherewithal to get involved in this, but I had many friends who did, who began to take this very seriously and become what was known in the scriptures, and oh, by the way, in the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, as communities of shared goods. We called them communists and hippies. And hippies. Well, communes, yeah. The hippies. Do you remember the hippies? Yeah. You had a couple running around, didn't you? Anyway, we've managed in our enlightened selves, and, you know, God helps those who help themselves approach to life, making fun of and anathematizing people like that who have tried, you know, over the generations to take this kind of stuff seriously. So here's Joan Chittister, this nun, who writes this. When we begin to accumulate, we begin to forget our common responsibility for the planet and all its peoples. What we need and what we want are two different things. And that, she says, can be hard to determine. But one thing is clear. When we have what we need, it is time to get serious about seeing that others have the same. Then we have to begin to do more than just charity. We must demand just legislation and sufficiency for everyone. Woo. And that is following the path of Jesus, and it's the path in the Gospel of Luke that he invites folks to embark upon. And so those of us who, you know, find ourselves in a similar position as Theophilus, to whom the Gospel of Luke is addressed, this patron who's got everything he needs and then some, to the extent that we are willing to become teachable and open to possibilities and follow a spiritual path that leads us not just into that crazy sense of self-sufficiency, but into a deeper sense of interconnectedness and interdependence, if you will, and out of that experience, seeing that there are those who are less fortunate than us and that we're willing not just to serve them, but to change our way of life in order to welcome them into the circle. Oh, wait, the God of refugees. To the extent that we're willing to do those things, those simple, simple things, you and I have a chance. We have a clean shot. So, take a deep breath. And then take another one, because we're going to need it.